So this morning, we are going to discuss the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is four chapters long, and I will be up here for 4 weeks. It's kismet. It's perfect. We're going to do a chapter a week. And now that I've told you I will be up here next week, if you don't show up, I'll know you did it on purpose. I'm just kidding. No, I'm joking. The book of Ruth is a weird little book. It's kind of a confusing book if you're trying to figure out, like, okay, what is going on here? I mean, some things are clear, but it's also clear that there are several different things going on below the surface of Ruth. And it's taken me a little bit of hand-holding to figure out what's going on. And I'm not there yet. I'm going to share with you what I've learned so far. I'd love your insights if I'd missed something. But I needed a little help to see what was going on below the surface. And to get us in a mindset to understand a little about what's going on with Ruth, I want to show this picture. I think as people, we love pictures like this. There's just something very aesthetically pleasing about this. But this is a perfect example of what the book of Ruth is in the context of Judges. So you may have been getting a plague of emails sent every Tuesday and Friday to your inbox if you've signed up for the Judges study. I know the students have, and they love it. They're absolutely enjoying it, I'm sure. We've been going through the book of Judges. It's a weird book. It's kind of a random book, but it's an extremely helpful book for us to see what obedience and disobedience looks like in being in relationship with God. And this is a great example of what the book of Ruth is in the context of Judges, because they take place in the same time. So this flower is the book of Ruth, and the parking lot or whatever concrete surrounding the flower is the book of Judges, kind of representing this barrenness of spirituality that the disobedience of Israel has led to in the book of Judges. And it's a tough book. If you've been following along, if you've read the book before, there are certain chapters that kind of churn my stomach. Because it's so upsetting to hear just how disobedient they were, just how little they understood Yahweh, the God of Israel, their God. And so we have Ruth, a pretty positive book. Not at the start, you'll see that. But in the end, a hopeful book, sprouting up in the midst of spiritual barrenness and brokenness, standing in stark contrast with one another. And so keep this image in your mind as we look at Ruth and as we look at it in context of the book of Judges. A little disclaimer here. If you've heard a sermon of mine, I tend to do this. We're going to read the whole chapter, but I'm going to take what will seem like forever on the first couple verses, but bear with me. We'll get through the whole thing, I promise. There's just so much context for the book of Ruth that if we don't talk about, then we don't fully understand what comes after in the book of Ruth. And so we need to understand the context, so I'm going to take forever on the first couple verses, but it's okay. It'll be fun, I promise. So let's start Ruth chapter 1. If you have your Bibles, I recommend cracking them open. It'll, of course, be up on the screen for us. We're going to start with just verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. Okay, clearly this first verse is setting the stage for the book of Ruth. Let's break this down. It says, in the time when the judges ruled. Now, my preferred Hebrew understanding of this is when the judges judged. I like that. I don't know. The judges, who are they? What's going on with the judges? Well, the judges were leaders of Israel. So God had given Israel the promised land of Canaan. They were to go into Canaan and settle it and conquer it because there were people groups that were living there. They didn't quite do the conquering part as well as they should have. They got a little scared at times, even though God, time and time again, had provided victory for them. And so they're in this place where they're being tempted by these other nations, tempted to worship their gods and worship their idols. And they fall into that. And God raises up judges or leaders for the country of Israel to be redeemed and for them to have peace. Because what was God's intention for Israel was to bless other nations, not accommodate, assimilate to other nations. And that's what they were doing through their disobedience. So in the book of Ruth takes place when the judges ruled, when the judges judged. And at that time, when the judges apparently were ruling, they were not conquered at this moment, there's a famine in the land. I think that's very important for us to realize. It's when the judges were in power, because like I said, there's kind of this cycle thing that would happen. This disobedience, this spiritual disobedience, spiritual slavery to these other gods would lead to physical enslavement by these nations that surrounded them and were living within them. And then they would ask, Lord, help us, we're enslaved. And God would raise up a judge. The judge would lead them to peace. And the peace would only last about a generation long. And then the cycle would continue. But this is a time, apparently, when one of those peace periods was happening. So the judges were ruling, but there was a famine in the land. Now, God uses physical things sometimes to let us know when there's a spiritual problem. That's a very common thing we see in the Bible, a famine being this physical drought where there's no food, this difficult time is indicative of a spiritual condition or a lack thereof. And so when the judges were ruling, there was a famine in the land. And to make this even worse, it says a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and his two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. Bethlehem in Judah. We're familiar with this place, probably. There were a few other Bethlehems, so this is where we want to know what's in Judah. That's why it's specific here. Judah being an area of Israel. Bethlehem. What does Bethlehem mean? Well, Danielle, our fearless worship leader, is still on her honeymoon. Thank goodness, because I'm about to say some Hebrew words and I don't always say them correctly. I get a little self-conscious. I think I always say them wrong, actually. But I'm going to give it a shot. So Bethlehem, Bet-Lechem, house of bread. That's what that means, house of bread. There's a famine in the house of bread. And the famine was so bad that these people left the country of Israel to go to Moab, another nation. A nation who at one time enslaved Israel. In Judges 3, God raises a judge to kill the king of Moab. But they're in such dire straits that they're leaving Israel, the promised land, to go to the nation of Moab, who serves a different god. There's something clearly wrong here. In just this first verse, the author of Ruth wants us to know something wasn't right in Israel. Things are not as they should be. All right, verse 2. Are you guys ready? I'm ready. I was ready a long time ago. Now, let's finally do it. Just kidding. That sarcasm was a joke. Let's loosen up a little bit. Okay, here we go. All right, verse 2. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to Moab and lived there. Okay, so we get a little more detail. We get some names for this family. We get this repetition. Again, Bethlehem, Judah. Again, they go to Moab. The author really wants us to know something's not right here. That this family is going to become refugees because of this famine in this other nation that does not serve Yahweh, the God of Israel. We can learn a lot from names. We get the man's name, Elimelech. Hebrew will provide us some meanings with these names, and people are named to mean something, and that really helps us understand some context. So, you know, if you go to seminary, you learn Hebrew, and then you forget it, and then you try to learn it again, and you have a hard time in a moment of crisis, and you Google it, and then you can figure out what this means. That was my personal journey. I don't know if you caught that. Okay. But I'm back. Tell my professors I'm back. Okay. Elimelech. What does this mean? It's two Hebrew words. Elimelech. Elimelech. Again, probably said wrong. That's okay. Elimelech. What does that mean? Melech means king. Eli means God. And so his name is literally God is king. That tells us a lot about his parents and potentially about him. So his parents raised him to believe that God is king. And this tells us that potentially he is a righteous man in a very unrighteous time. And I think we can assume that he was a guy who believed that his God was king. And this reminds us of Judges 9, the story of Gideon's son, Abimelech. Now, Gideon, you may be familiar with the story of how he had like a sweatshirt that he wanted God to make wet and then not wet or something like that. As a, that was actually a good thing. He was trying to learn about God's nature, about who God was. And he became a pretty decent judge. He saved Israel from the Midianites with his 300 men. And when he was done saving Israel, the people came to him and said, "Man, Gideon, you're so cool. You should be our king." And Gideon said, "No. God is our king. I shouldn't be king. We have a king, and it's God." That's a good answer. That was great. Gideon's a cool guy, right? But after that, he started doing things that were very king-like, even though he did not claim to be a king himself. He centered worship around himself. He created a dynasty, having tons of children. He grew in wealth more than anybody else. And one thing he did was he had a son with a prostitute, and he named that son Abimelech. Now, you guys, you probably caught this. You're pretty smart, okay? Elimelech, Abimelech, those sound similar. Maybe this shares one of the same words, and it does. Melech, king. But what's the Abimelech part? Well, Abi, what's that? Well, in Hebrew, the B's and the V's get a little switched around. I'm not smart enough to explain that to you. Just take my word for it. So the word is Avi. Avi, father. My father is king. So we have Abimelech, my father is king, and Elimelech, God is king. And I think the author of Ruth really wants us to take note of this. That there are polar opposites here happening at the same time of Judges. You have a judge who is supposed to lead well and follow God, naming his son my father is king. And then Abimelech goes on to be one of the worst characters in the book of Judges. In fact, when I mentioned that my stomach churned a little bit at one of the chapters, it was the chapter with Abimelech and his complete lack of understanding of who God was and his desire to be his own God and the leader of Israel. And then we have Elimelech, a guy we don't learn much about, but from his name we can assume he's a righteous man in an unrighteous time. But he does not last long. Verses 3 through 6. We're going to do bigger chunks. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth, after they had lived there about 10 years. Both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. Okay, so there's this famine in Bethlehem in the house of bread. Naomi, her husband, and her two sons go to Moab. They're refugees because of this famine. They're in a different nation, serving a different god. Her husband dies at some point. We don't know how her husband or her sons die. The point is that they died. And her husbands before, or sorry, the her sons, before they died, of course, they had wives, Moabite women, Naomi and Orpah. And so now Naomi is left with her two daughters-in-law. All three of these women are left in a very desperate situation. I think it's pretty easy to see why their situation is so desperate. First of all, the amount of grief and sadness that they're all going through is immense and intense. Any of you here who have lost a spouse or a child, unfortunately, already understand this story much more than those of us who haven't. And I believe that those of you who find yourself in that camp, unfortunately, who know that tragedy, I believe you can find a special peace and comfort in this book. And I want to help you find that and be on the lookout for it. Now, second of all, beyond the immense emotional trauma that they're experiencing, they're in a very different culture than our own. Obviously, the Bible was written a pretty long time ago. It's an old book. Mine is clearly old because of the duct tape that is holding it together. But more than that, it's an old book with old cultures and systems of society, and we need to understand that a little bit. Also, we need to understand our own culture and society and how maybe it's still a part of that, but we need to know to get good context of what is going on, what their situation is like, by looking at patriarchy. Patriarchy is full-fledged what is going on in the book of Ruth in their culture. Under a patriarchal system, a woman derives her value from men. The greatest value a woman in this system can have is through having sons. It's clearly not a healthy system if that's the only way a woman has value. In our country today, in the world today, the system is not as normative as it unfortunately is in some parts of the world. However, women are not treated equally to men in many different ways in every part of the world. In this system, the culture is defined by men and the society is run by men. And the book of Ruth provides a good critique against patriarchy. And it will show us how God desires men and women to work together to further his kingdom, a sort of blessed alliance. But in this context, the death of Naomi's sons represents the complete destruction of her life's work. Naomi is past childbearing years, so she essentially has no future and no hope, something that she'll explain later on. Ruth and Orpah, for whatever reasons, they don't have any sons to support them. They no longer have husbands to support them. I've read and heard some atrocious stories of just how seriously our world takes having sons instead of daughters. Even today, there are cultures where a woman gives birth to a daughter and cries, not out of joy, but out of sadness and sorrow because she had a daughter and not a son. And she knows what that means for her status within her family and within her world. There are stories where women like Ruth, who fail to produce a son, experience abuse at the hands of either their husband or their in-laws. And we don't see this in Ruth, but it was a reality back then, and it's unfortunately a reality today in some places. The value of women is nowhere equal to men in our world. In the United States, even, the devaluing of women is more subtle. It's less explicit than in some other cultures. I don't have time to get into it, but Google gender wage gap and you'll see a big problem in our society. It's just one example. Now, in other places around the world, daughters are killed, abandoned, abused, etc., for being women and not men. And as the father of an 8-month-old daughter, this doesn't make sense to me. In some remote cultures, women who lose their husband are burned on his funeral pyre with him alive. I read a story about a 4-year-old girl whose husband died. A 4-year-old girl whose husband died. And they were going to burn her alive on his funeral pyre. And thank God that one of her relatives was able to smuggle her out of her village in that context so that she's safe. But she's now exiled from her family, from her home. As a kid, what choice did she have? I know this is an extreme example, but it's sadly not an uncommon reality. And I say all this to explain that Ruth and Orpah and Naomi have lost their value in their system, in their society, especially Naomi, whose story is essentially over. And I say all this for us to realize the patriarchal treatment of women is not archaic or foreign, but remains in some form today. And I'm pretty sure the women I'm speaking to know it in some way. But it's important for us as men to know it too, and hopefully do something about it. Verses 7 through 14. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. So Naomi is returning to Bethlehem because the famine is over and she doesn't really have anything in Moab. Her daughters-in-law, which she refers to as her daughters, want to join her, but she's telling them, looking out for their best interests, she's telling them to stay. They potentially have a chance going back to their previous family. They could potentially find husbands, men who would take pity on them. In this system, if a daughter was married off, it was typical that her new family became her primary family. And it's also typical that the man who was in charge in that situation would make all the decisions. So women didn't really have many choices to make. The men made it for them. So whether they had a husband who would make those decisions, or maybe their husband died and they had a son, their son would make those decisions. And so now they have no men to make decisions. Naomi is the one making decisions, and these two women are looking to her. And Orpah listens. And let me just take a moment to say, you should all be proud of me for saying Orpah and not Oprah. When I practiced this, I may have said Oprah on accident a couple times, but I don't believe I said it once this morning, so hey, just saying. Orpah listens to Naomi. We should not look down on Orpah for leaving. She listens to the wishes of her mother-in-law. But Ruth clung to Naomi. Verses 15 through 17. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." In verse 16, we hear Ruth's voice. She speaks up for herself. She makes a decision. Like I said, she doesn't make a lot of decisions because that's not her society, her system. But in this moment, she speaks against her mother-in-law's wishes, and she says, "No, I will stay." This is the first of many moments where Ruth displays great faith and loyalty. We'll see more of those as we go on. Ruth decides that she will become an immigrant in the country of Israel, a place she's never lived. And she'll worship a God she most likely doesn't know that well. Maybe she knows a little bit in her head, but she doesn't know him in her heart. She will not leave her mother-in-law to suffer alone. Ruth even invokes Yahweh to punish her if she does not keep this promise. I think she does this to affirm that she is following Naomi's God and is also following him in the statement of dedication by acknowledging God's sovereignty. I believe that is something she has learned from Naomi. What does it mean that God is sovereign? That means God is the authority over everything. That he is in control, that he is all-powerful. Like I said, I don't think she knows a whole lot about God. We're not sure here, but I think she's learned all she knows from Naomi, and she's learned it well. Verses 18 through 22. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me." The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Verse 22 concludes the first chapter, and it sets up what's going to happen in the second chapter. It lets us know that the famine was over, so the barley harvest was beginning. But it also kind of sets the stage for chapter 2, because what do Naomi and Ruth need? The basics for survival. They need food. And so we'll see how the barley harvest fits into the story next week. But Naomi and Ruth, they return to these people who barely recognize Naomi. It's been 10 years. You know, she's aged a little bit. But in addition to that, I think tragedy is carried in a very physical way. I think tragedy doesn't just affect us emotionally or spiritually, but I think it affects us physically, and how we look, how we talk, how we sound, how we carry ourselves. I think we're supposed to know that Naomi is a changed person because of what has happened to her. And she tells us, she says she went away full, but the Lord has returned her empty. She blames all of this on the Lord, who has brought misfortune upon her. But in all this, she never questions his character. She never abandons him. In doing so, she's acknowledging his sovereignty and that what has happened to her was all within his control. It may seem like Naomi is not displaying faith very well, but she actually is. She's lamenting well. Lament is a very important concept for us to understand in the Bible. It's the idea of going to God with your frustrations, with your pain, with your anger, with your broken heart, and being honest with him, telling him how you feel, asking him what's going on, what are you doing? Because all of that is going to him. It's going to the right source, the one who is in complete authority. If you don't believe me, there's a book called Lamentations, which is good proof that it's important. It's done all over the Bible. And Naomi is doing that as she is speaking to these people who barely recognize her. And this brings us to a very important method for understanding the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is mainly three main characters. It's Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz. Chapter 1, clearly Naomi was the focus. Then we'll focus on Ruth, and then we'll meet Boaz in the next chapter. I don't think it was called all those three names, because that'd be kind of confusing. But it's also Ruth who's kind of the catalyst for a lot of the amazing things that happen in this book. And Ruth represents someone that we know in the Bible. All three of these characters represent someone we know. Ruth is representing Abraham, who in Genesis was called by a God he barely knew to leave everything that he knew and be the father of this nation, the nation of Israel, in a different place, serving a God he was just beginning to understand. And Abraham went. And so we see Ruth in her Abraham moment. She doesn't really know God, but she leaves and goes to follow him and follow her mother-in-law. Now, Naomi represents Job. The book of Job is an interesting book in the Old Testament. It's a book about a man who loses everything. God allows him to lose everything. Satan asks if he can do that, and God says, we'll see how Job responds. And so the whole book is Job's response and the response of the people around him, some friends and other men who challenge the way that he is lamenting, challenge the questions that he's asking, the doubt he might have. And the book ends with God showing up and declaring his sovereignty. Who made the winds? Who made the ocean? Who made the animals? Who are you to ask? That whole book is all about God's sovereignty, and Naomi is our Job in this situation, a woman who loses everything but knows that God is still in control, and God is able to restore and redeem her. At the end of Job, Job is restored, not to where he was before, because the people he lost don't come back from the dead or anything like that. He's experienced pain and struggle, but he's experienced that with God and come out at the end redeemed and restored. And we'll see that happen with Naomi as well. What we need to ask as we conclude this morning and as we continue on in the book of Ruth, we need to ask, where is God? Has God spoken at all in this chapter? No. They've talked about God. Where is God? Why is he allowing all this tragedy to happen to seemingly righteous people? It's a good question to ask. Specifically asking, where are you, God? Because it's directed to him. So my question for you as we conclude this morning is, what do you do when the future is uncertain and you are close to losing hope? Maybe something has happened in your life, a tragedy of any degree, an unresolved pain, a persistent personal struggle, a sin struggle. How do you speak to God in those difficult moments? Are you honest with him? Are you honest with him about your frustrations and your pain and your grief like Naomi was? Do you abandon God when it feels like he has abandoned you? I realize this application is quite general and open-ended, but I believe that you can easily think of something. Maybe this morning you identify with Naomi because you literally have lost a child, either through death or separation of some kind. Or maybe you identify with Naomi and Ruth and Orpah because you have lost a spouse, either through death or separation of some kind. And you don't know where to go. You don't know what to do, what to think. Maybe you relate to Ruth and Naomi because you are a woman who has felt the pressure, anxiety, and inequality, etc., that the world imposes on you because you are women. But we can all relate to these women because we all, in our own way, have experienced the brokenness of the world and the tragedies that come with that. Now remember, this is in the time of the judges when fear of what will happen on a local, national, and global scale is always on their mind. Anything could change at any moment. I think we can relate to that. These are people trying to follow God in a country that abandons God over and over and over again. I think we can relate to that. In the midst of fear, pain, and tragedy, do you abandon God? Do you allow yourself to believe that God has abandoned you? Even if you do believe that, do you talk to him? Do you go to him? Do you share your heart with him? If you do, he will let you know that he's still there. Because he is still there. And he still cares about you. And he's working out your redemption. Even if you can't see it, if you can't feel it. Sometimes even if it's hard to believe it. Believe it. He is working. He's right next to you. He grieves when you grieve. He weeps when you weep. He cares so deeply for you. Ruth and Naomi are in a desperate situation, but in just 4 chapters, we'll see their lives transformed and redeemed. And through their redemption, we'll see the world's redemption. Pray with me. Lord, I thank you that you are a God who will not stop. You will continue to work in us, through us, and around us so that we can be redeemed. Lord, we await the day your Son returns and restores this earth once and for all. And sin will be no more. Brokenness, tragedy will be no more. And we won't have to just believe you're right here with us. We can see you right here with us. Lord, I pray that you would open our eyes and our ears to hear you and see you moving. And know that you are there. And always go to you, no matter what is happening in this world. Always go to you because you will provide hope in times of hopelessness. I thank you, Lord, for that. Help us to lean on you and your understanding in everything that we do. It's in your Son's name we pray. Amen.
This has been a message from Gaines Church in Caledonia, Michigan. We'd love to have you join us at one of our Sunday services. Visit gaineschurch.org for more information. One life, one hope, one destination.